You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap?
Welcome to Law of Attraction Radio Network's Quantum Leap Book Club. Our host, Parisha, is currently traveling and teaching today, and you'll be joined by the co-host, myself, Geraldine Dalby-Ball, and I'm an environmental biologist based in Sydney, Australia. We also have Trina Cooper, a lifelong entrepreneur from Denver, Colorado, Rosemary Heyer, an English teacher working with children from Frankfurt, Germany, Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer, who's a doctor of naturopathy and an RN, and she's based in Kingman, Arizona. And we have Marianne Love, who's a clinical psychologist based in Melbourne, Australia. And we're currently studying How to Suffer in 10 Easy Steps by William Ernst. And it's been a fantastic book. We've been reading chapter 6 to date, and we're currently on page 68, and we'll be going through some of chapter 6 and then finding out how to blame others and how to disempower yourself, all in an easy next hour. So welcome joining us on our Quantum Leap Book Club session, and I'd like to first ask our wonderful co-host to come on board with what they have from this part of the end or the concluding part of chapter 6.
Hello, this is Rosemary, and I would love to speak on that. Actually, the last part of the chapter, he's coming up with another easy step to have fun with suffering. Easy step number 8 is let technology be your guide. And he is referring to that also because of the techno stress he was sharing before that. But also it's really interesting because he's then sharing about the Amish people, and he's actually saying that they have a way not to have technology be their guide, but really making a choice based on their own core value, how they use technology. And I think he's really sharing some interesting things that they actually are not against technology at all, but they take a very cautious way to undergo observations and experimenting with it and discussing it in the community and really looking at the idea of is this technology really helping them? So they actually checking the impact on their community. And as some of you might not know, the Amish people arrived from Europe in 1700, and they live in small communities in the United States, in the countries. For example, a lot of them live in Ohio, and they are usually not using technology or electricity. And one of their core values, how they actually check that is, and I find that really interesting, is does the technology really bring family and community together, or does it break it apart? And I think that's a wonderful question we all could ask ourselves if we are using new technology. Is it supporting our family or our community in which we live in, or is it really bringing a break into that? The way they are organized is they have bishops, and they get together twice a year, and they actually discuss the technology and decide if this should be permitted in the community or be banned. The core value is really how does it support their society, and then they decide. So basically, they have the choice, and they're not letting technology run their life. They actually make the choice. There's one example about this, and that is regarding the cell phone, how they use the cell phones. They decide that they not allow them at home. They say it disrupts dinner conversation, it interrupts religious devotion time, practices, or conversations. And what they actually do is they leave the cell phone outside in a little booth, a solar charge booth, or some kind of box where they leave it outside until the next morning. I think I thought that was really a great idea. I'll leave it from here, and maybe another co-host wants to share.
Yes, Rosemary, that's a really good point, and I like how you brought that one up too, for a question for all of us to ask. Does the technology bring families and the community together, or does it break them apart? And I love too how they give that other example of a gas barbecue. It's a new piece of technology relative to the more pure way that the Amish use technology, but it passed that particular question. So when they asked that, yes, the gas barbecue did bring families and community together because people all came around and ate, obviously. So yeah, that's great you brought that one up. And yes, you're absolutely right. We do have more comments on this section.
Hi, this is Joyce in Kingman, Arizona. And I had a lot of fun reading the little scenario about Carol, because I definitely have had some interesting experiences with my cell phone. In a 12-month period, I managed to destroy or lose or whatever 3 cell phones and had to buy new ones. And they weren't just cheap cell phones, but it was amazing how I managed to budget everything else so that I could get another cell phone. So in 1 year, I bought 3 cell phones. So the story of Carol and the craziness that went on in her day, because she was totally depending on that incredible cell phone to lead her to the appointment that she needed to get so that she would look beautiful for the appointment she was meeting a very important person at the end of the day. So I had to identify with her stress, but I also had to laugh a little bit because I could identify with what she was going through. So it was definitely worth looking at, because we do depend, or many of us do depend on our cell phones. And in my experience of that time, in those 3 experiences of not having a cell phone and the delay before I get the next one, was I realized I depend on it for connecting with my children. I depend on it for my work. I depend on it for most of planning my social events. And it's actually a social tool for me. So I just had to chuckle that Carol created this absolutely insane day for herself, and I could relate to it. So that's worth reading for anyone who has the book.
Yes, I totally agree. It is about the relating and the chuckle. If we can do both of those things, we can really alleviate suffering, because there's quite a few times through the reading where I have then gone, aha, I see the mirror. I can now see myself doing that. That's a good point. Have a realization, have a chuckle, and that's one of the solutions to suffering, not one of the easy steps. And I know that we do have Marianne also, who has some information on this part. So welcome you to the call.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be on. I think it's really interesting. I'd love to do a measure or study on happiness level of the Amish people. And I wonder that their happiness levels might be higher than the rest of the population, because, you know, as William says here, like when you think about it, we use more and more technology and we've potentially even become the slaves, not necessarily the masters of it. And are people happier? And the answer is no. People are suffering more, even though our technology has freed us up so much. I mean, we're achieving so much more and things are so much easier. We're not living in the, many of us are not living in the physical kind of hardships we used to be. And yet there's so much depression and anxiety and people locked into the negativities of their mind and feeling trapped within their emotional well-being. So I'm really curious, you know, if you stick to traditional values or important values to you, like the Amish are doing, and are very conscious and aware about what they're allowing to change their communities, makes a very big difference to change and being able to free yourself. So it's really cool to hear that there is a community of people that live consciously and uphold the values that are true for them in that way. And it really does make us look at technology and does it serve us? And that's important to keep questioning, I think, because it's so easy to get lost in the intrigue of it, you know, and waste time going down those rabbit holes. of technology, but, you know, is it helpful? Does it bear fruit? You know, does it grow corn, as Grandmother Parish often teaches us?
I think that's a great question, and having that ability to confront ourselves, to see it. Like, for example, I was doing some posts on Facebook, and then I found myself watching one or two videos, and then I found myself watching four or five, and they're 4 minutes each, and I went, wow, that's half an hour gone. And straight away, I started to apply the stick and then suffer from telling myself what a waste of time, so many other things I could do. And then very quickly laughing and thinking of this book and say, well, how long would I like to suffer? Because it's not necessarily what happens, but then what happens with it. So as you said, it takes an effort to stay conscious. It also takes an effort to say, okay, done. Now, next. So that's interesting what you say about the technologies and being our choice. Has anyone got a comment on that? Because I know Trina is very ready to, with some information as well.
Yeah, hi, this is Trina in Denver. And I'll tell you, this whole idea of technology stress or techno stress and techno suffering, I mean, even today coming in, we had an issue with the security program expiring, but we couldn't get the password to work. And it's like, how many passwords do we need to know? How many logins do we need to know now? How many security questions are there? And every one of the things that we do, they say, oh, don't use the same one, use something different. And so we've had to come up with different strategies in our lives in order to keep track of all of these things, because we want our technologies to work. And I watch how things get shut down. The other day, just a frustration of the internet not working and not being able to send an email when I needed to send an email, and grabbing my cell phone and trying to create a hotspot with it. So it seems that we're developing different strategies in how to cope. It's like that question that's asked in this chapter is, who is the master? And so are you going to let technology get to you, like the story about Carol, or are you going to develop strategies, cheat sheets, ways of dealing? I know for me, sometimes I just have to sit down and breathe for a little bit and say, okay, because sometimes when you get an update, it knocks everything off. And coming from the business point of view, so many businesses just rely really heavily on technology anymore. And when one little piece goes down and isn't working, it kind of sets off a whole domino effect and can knock things, off, and it impacts other people then. And so this is really something, it's like, I don't know if there's a book that's been written about how to deal with techno stress or techno suffering, but I thought it was interesting in here, and I don't think we talked about it last week, that there was actually a definition of techno suffering. And he said it occurs when stress, frustration, and helplessness associated with technology get so much that the threshold of suffering is reached and someone like blows their top, and he calls it a technical term. But how many times do you see people really hit that level of being so frustrated that they just completely lose it because they can't get something to work and they can't get something wired up and they can't get their Bluetooth going? So, you know, it means developing new resources, and it means developing the strategies and really looking at what you have. Like, do you have people that can help you? I wouldn't think of trying to resolve some of these technical issues anymore without having some resources or people that I can talk to, because my time isn't spent on focusing on how to fix technology when it's not working. I just want somebody to do it for me and make it better. So, you know, that's one strategy I have. But I think the idea of really looking at what you have and whether it's mastering you and driving you, or whether you are the master making the choices, putting the plans in place, developing your strategies, and noticing, really becoming aware when it's starting to get to you and being able to resolve that. So that's my little two cents about some of this.
Yes, and it as you're saying, it feels like a two cents. It feels really obvious. And it's that ability that we have, and when do we have the ability? And sometimes when we're doing things that allow us to get so-called overwhelmed by the technology is when we're not necessarily feeling our full working on all full cylinders, and that's when the tools, you just give yourself a rule. If this is happening, that's my tool. helps, because when we're in a great happy mindset, we can say, well, of course, I just put it down. I know that's not useful for me. Or I know that reaction's not useful for me. Suffer meter, as we've gone through earlier in the book. And the suffer meter can then let us know, and you can let others know, which is importantly, that your suffer meter is quite low today. And it might be that even your tool could be, if you see me scrolling through Facebook or whatever it might be, come and take the phone off me if you feel like doing that. That's just an example. Or you could have your own suffer meter on knowing it's low, so you give yourself a 5-minute alarm. Whatever the tools are, the more real we are with ourselves, the more we can laugh at ourselves, the more we can correct. And I know Trina's got a comment as well.
I just had one little thing you kind of triggered a little bit with me too, and it made me think of a little program I was part of the other day, which was talking about developing info products online, you know, for online products for people. And so the host, my partner that was teaching it, she was talking about, oh, well, you can do an ebook, and you can do a video chat, and you can do audio things. And she's just going like so fast and putting, you know, and saying, this is what you need, just this, this, and this. And I thought about the technologies that are needed to do some of these things. And I think one of the biggest things we need to do is give ourselves time and be really patient, because a lot of this is learning new skills. And we always have bumps in the road when we're learning new skills. It always takes time. Like, I forget who just said it a little bit ago, we've got to laugh at ourselves, but allow for the time, allow for the goof-ups, and be really patient with yourself, because you're just like a little kid that is struggling to learn how to tie a shoe or ride a bike or whatever. It takes practice. And so a lot with the new technologies, it really takes practice, and it takes some education too, because like on the medical side of things, when they start talking about all of these programs and the new technologies they have, ask a lot of questions. Don't just sit there, nod your head with a blank look. Ask the questions and make yourself knowledgeable about what you're doing. That was just my little bit other feedback that you kind of pulled out of me.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I know Rosemary's...
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about that techno-stress thing too, because I think the Amish people are such a good example of how they try to protect their family life from that in their ways. Because I just recently followed a discussion with parents regarding the smartphone use of children. And that's a big, big influence. And it's really what William Arndt probably would call big time suffering. Because the parents are actually completely helpless about the situation of the children being in constant communication with their peers, which is so important for them, of course, via their smartphone. And actually one parent said it looks like the smartphone is an extension of their body. And I think if you watch them after school, or I watch them after my courses I do with them, I mean, that's the first thing they do, whip out that phone, and then that's on all the time. So that's really a big challenge for many families. How do you deal with that? And they have tried everything what they could, but it is really a way of communicating with the kids, and they just love it. And the other thing is, I noticed myself, someone was asking me too, well, why are you using this smartphone all the time when you're at my place, when you're waiting for something? And I said, you know, I'm not actually using it. I'm cleaning it up. What I'm noticing is, and Trina mentioned some of that, is that technology takes such a time also to be taken care of. No, you have to delete the messages or delete things so your storage doesn't get full, or, you know, you have to go through the messages and quickly answer, and then you have another thread, and then you have an email. And And so just taking care of technology, sometimes I wish there would be someone right next to me, takes my phone and does all these things all the time. And also the other thing is that school is actually, in, at least in Germany, supporting that technology very much. I mean, they are asking the kids to have a printer at home, to have a computer at home, and one parent was complaining that he had to buy all that stuff. And they are actually using the smartphone also to do their homework and help each other out. So it's really difficult to deal with that in that situation for the parents. And I think that we need to find ways to help them and support the parents and the children to find a balanced way in that. And of course, one way is to have a fast, to have a smartphone fast, even if it's some couple of hours or an hour a day with the whole family, and or, you know, find certain times they only allow to use it at home, and you know, all kinds of rules probably a lot of parents have been coming up with. So I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Yes. And I hear what you're saying there, and I know sometimes I get a surprise with my children's use. The other morning, my son was on his phone and then said there was this wonderful way to make big fluffy omelets. And he showed me, and I said, how did you learn that? He said, it was on TikTok. And I said, really? He said, yeah, I always subscribe to all the food things. So I wouldn't have necessarily put my mind in a place to say, oh, great, you know, he's on the phone. There's this automatic idea that being on the phone is mindless, and yet he's actually pursuing information on a topic that he really likes that he's not getting from another source. So I think that inquiring as well as a tool of how to not have it, but inquire as a tool as to how you are using it. How does this, like the Amish say, how is using that particular app or that particular phone thing contributing to? So maybe it's about finding those sets of agreements and values and see how they contribute to. And I know Marianne also has information on this.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I was just thinking in the book he talks about scientific materialism quite a lot, which means that for people who believe that there's nothing beyond space and time or our five senses. So it kind of pretty much means that what you see and what you can prove with your five senses is what science will accept. If you look at technology, we've got some powerful creative minds on the planet that are just forging and paving new ways in technology. And I think there's a lot of us that feel like it's a full-time job just keeping up with being able to use certain programs and even know, like, I'm happy if I can get something working on my computer, let alone innovating it. So I think we need to all look at what side of the fence we sit on and explore, like, do we just trust our five senses, or do we pursue knowledge and information that says and explores beyond what physics, I guess, the common physics that we might have learned at school has taught us, or do we seek out quantum physics and the, you know, cutting edge of science and understanding so that we can explore ourselves beyond our five senses and that we can master our happiness and our life and what we create and not be behind the game like we are, like we often get a sense of we are with technology. You know, can we be in front of the game by expanding and not just believing, you know, scientific materialism like it's a fact, you know what I mean? So I think it's great to explore all of this.
I absolutely hear what you're saying there, and part of that question is, you know, to decide who's the master and who's the slave. So it doesn't mean any piece of technology is a problem at any time, but who's making the choice? And I guess that could be the same as food types. It could be the same as anything. So, yeah, developing our mindset so that we are the master. And another part of, right at the end of chapter 6 there, that part that it's really reinforcing that because we're not physically needing to suffer, I totally acknowledge there's still physical suffering in the world, but even people who don't have cold, don't have hunger, those basic things, they do have comfort, they're still suffering. So it illuminates that suffering is more than physical. And I know Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer has some input in this part as well.
Hi, yes, what I wanted to sort of enlarge on about the master and the slave kind of two aspects of how you would use the suffering. I had fun this week trying to imagine a traveler from outer space has arrived here on Earth, And we human beings want to teach this traveler about us. So we pick up this lovely book about How to Suffer by William Arndt. And this author has presented us with a plan so we all can be master sufferers. So what greater thing to share with these visitors? So step by step, he builds exactly how you can make the most greatest benefit of being the best sufferer in the world. But what I realized as I was looking at it more closely was in the process of him teaching how to be a master sufferer, he's actually teaching us the reverse as well, because he always has some comments, like the example of the Amish is perfect, that there's more than one side to suffering, and suffering can actually serve us if it moves us to a new stage and helps us change. So that was kind of fun to picture hosting this visitor from outer space and helping them to understand the ones of us on this planet that we're suffering, but also to understand that we are totally capable of using suffering in a positive way and be stronger.
Totally. And I really hear what you're saying there in terms of the duality of it. There's two sides, and just really flip it. And there's quite a few therapies that show us we can just flip whatever statement it is, whatever feeling it is, because if one is there, the opposite is there. And that's a good way of, if, for example, the next one that we're moving to in Chapter 7, where the big title is Blame Them. So I guess while Mr. Ernst is introducing us as a potential step of feeling okay about things and getting suffering, blame other people. So, of course, there's, as you said, subtly it's telling us, well, hey, take responsibility. And I know Rosemary's got information on this whole concept of blaming somebody else as a solution to suffering.
Yeah, I love that chapter in a way, because it is so common, isn't it? And I have been in that way too. And sometimes I feel like I get into that and I watch myself. So I like how he says, well, we can't blame God anymore. He's off the hook because we decided that being here means you're suffering. So that's it, right? But now you can claim someone else, maybe. That would work. And I think he's right in saying that, first of all, you know, it is giving you certainly a relief to yell at someone or blame politicians or blame the weather or anything like that. And if you don't watch it and if you're not aware of yourself, it easily slips your lips that you say something like that. And you don't even mean it. That's how much society and even myself, like sometimes I get entrenched in that. So then when you blame someone else, you are a victim. And he says, this is really nice because you can get tension and you feel you're suffering and you poor victim, what they are doing with you. But I thought an important part of being a victim or blaming someone is also, I don't have to do anything about it. I mean, if it's them, you know, then they need to do it. I cannot fix it. They have to do it. The politicians have to do it, or the authorities have to do it, because they are the stupid ones who caused it. And that's so common, isn't it? And we feel so helpless, and the media is full of that. And actually, I think the media lives from that way of thinking and this way of believing that you have to blame others for what is happening in your life, and you cannot do anything about it. So after all, it's not my fault, and I'm the victim, and I cannot do anything. So I like the idea he's speaking about, that we are easily doing it, sometimes people even faking suffering, and then they even don't notice how their brain get hardwired and how they get really into it, and that there's a constant way of living, that it's always the other person. And I feel personally that this is a very, very big thing in our society, and it doesn't allow to move many times into solutions, especially on the political arena. And I noticed that when you do that, you feel disempowered. I feel disempowered, and I cannot do anything. So getting out of blaming someone else is really a very big, big step in your own awareness, I think, and in my own awareness, so that I am then can say, okay, there's something I can do about it. What could it be? At least I open the door to ideas, and I open the door to possibilities and to intuitions and to impulses, and then I can act on that. So that's for that right now for this chapter for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Really strong points. And as we know, it's been written as easy step number 5, and play the blame game in the first place. You know, play the blame game. And I think, as you're saying, Rosemary, it's something that, you know, people can happen, and it just starts happening. And I think it's interesting that the Williams used the word or the phrase play the blame game. And it's getting into a role. It's getting into a character. And also, as you mentioned, you know, and Marianne mentioned this as well, it can be that you actually become addicted to it. And just to take one quick moment again to share, anyone who's really interested, once you've looked at yourself, had a laugh, and you're putting some of those tools in to stop and change this, or you're noticing it in someone else and you're suggesting some tools, the whole concept of the biology of belief and the concept of our biochemistry getting addicted to a certain way of feeling, victim is such a common feeling that can easily become addicted. You can become addicted to being a victim. And it means the cells that are now have empty receptor sites because they're waiting for that feeling, they send messages up to the brain, you know, to say, we need more of that particular chemical sent down as a substance because our cells are empty and hungry for that feeling, which is the physical translation of what helplessness feels like or victim feels like. So it's about taking control of yourself or assisting others to see it, that to get out of that habit of being a victim, you have to treat it like nicotine or sugar or anything else. Cold turkey, stop it going in. Make the duration shorter. Catch yourself. Have a laugh. Until as your cells, as your whole body changes itself and your cells divide and recreate, they won't make as many receptor sites for that feeling, and you'll have the body sending less messages to the brain requesting that feeling. And it's really marvelous. So check out that whole chemical addiction to emotions and help yourself and others go out of this game that is a blame game. So just that little bit because it's quite powerful. Okay, and ready for more.
This is Marianne. Yeah, I love this topic because this is what I live and breathe all day with my clients and sometimes with myself. So I really was interested when he said that, you know, we look at all the characters around us and, you know, sometimes we'll blame more than one person and more than one character, and it, you know, makes me really think about how we all have internal characters. And those internal characters are like roles. They're a bit like their own personalities that can be very different from each other within us. And those personalities want to keep functioning. So they keep acting themselves out in various situations. So there's invariably the blamer or the victim in one of those characters, or the one that felt helpless, and, you know, a variety of sort of inner people that express themselves in their day-to-day life. And unless we get conscious of that, we'll keep recreating dramas and experiences that allow room for those inner characters to come out. So, like, let's say you've got an inner victim, then it will pick a partner, it will pick friends and scenarios where unconsciously, mostly, it will find a match to itself. And so it might find someone who's a bit of a bully, or find a scenario where it actually gets to come out as the victim and gets to express itself, because everything wants survival, everything wants existence. So unless you get conscious to help it move and change, it keeps functioning. And in some of the work that I do, I notice that, you know, these consciousness states really develop in past experiences often, where the situation looked very true. So maybe at a time when you're very young, like 3 years old or 4 years old, something happens and decisions are made for you, or feel very powerless to change something. So it gets imprinted at a very, you know, significant times in life, and then continues to be reinforced just by acting it out. And it's very understandable because it looks true. I mean, it looks like the scenario is that you're a victim. It feels like the scenario is you're a victim. So then all the senses are kind of validating an old experience and an old perspective. And I often notice in the work, when you can bring conscious awareness to that and let go of the emotional charge that's sat within that character or that role or those old experiences, people are then able to actually let go of the whole game of victim and the whole game of blame, because there's no payoff anymore. There's nothing trying to validate itself anymore. You know, often the validation or the payoff is just that we want to be right, and our right is validating our worldview. Sometimes it's just, you know, wanting to draw in sympathy, and that's how we get connections. You know, I think it's worth everyone doing some free writing when you notice those aspects of self coming out, when you notice any feeling you don't want to live anymore, free write from it, because it will tell you what it is. And then you've got a lot of room to shift it. So I think it's really powerful to explore this topic of payoffs and get conscious about that.
Yes. While you were speaking, I was thinking of all the literature that's about and people's experience of that codependence as well. And I could see how when you're saying, you know, someone's being a victim and someone's being a bully, there's a natural coming together there because they're both fulfilling each other's suffering. Possibly why people go back to dysfunctional relationships, because there's an addiction to the suffering. And also, as you said, when you get conscious of it, it can be moved on. But it is the self. It reminded me of a story again from our host, Parisha, with regards to the butterfly story about allowing someone to go through their own learning. So provide that protective space, provide the information, let them push through their own cocoon, and in doing so, gather the information, gather the learnings, gather the strength that allows them to emerge as the beautiful butterfly, rather than just telling them this is how it is. And with what you're saying, you know, that importance of the self-realization, when a person can go, oh, I'm going back, or I'm recreating that sort of relationship because, or I keep finding in work this happens, or, you know, it's just quite a magic moment to see someone go, ah. And when you feel yourself do it and have a realization, it's an ah. Yes.
Absolutely. And I think it's really powerful when that happens to explore your own negative beliefs. Like, people hold, you know, beliefs like I'm powerless and beliefs like I'm unsafe, and they're so deeply ingrained, we don't realize we're generating scenarios to act them out. So, you know, whenever there's a situation, find the negative anchor that's just programmed. It doesn't make it true because it's programmed. It's just been programmed like a computer might be programmed. So finding them and then re-scripting those beliefs, and then everything changes.
Yeah, it absolutely can change. And Joyce, you have some comments too.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the little cartoon because it really triggered a lot in me and the work that I do with sick people. I realized, and it's kind of fun to read the statement underneath this little picture of the doctor and the patient, and the doctor saying, would you describe the pain everyone else causes you as dull and throbbing or sharp like a knife? So what where my mind went with this little cartoon was I realized over time, and hopefully this is getting less of a factor, but there is some kind of almost an attention getting statement or almost a prestige when a person can say, I have to go to a doctor's appointment. And then after they go to the doctor, they proudly say, the doctor started me on an antibiotic. So the doctor's comments in this little cartoon, but also in real life, often feed the victim consciousness. I don't know a doctor in my awareness that would actually confront the patient and say, well, what do you think you might have done or thought, or what could you do differently that might help you not be where you're at right now? So much as that sounds like a hilarious statement, he's asking, what did everyone else do that caused you this? It's kind of a realistic little cartoon. And I think one that we all can think about, because what do individually any of us do when we're sitting in the doctor's office? Are we telling him as much of a story of woe as we possibly can tell him? Or are we telling him some of the strengths and why this isn't nothing that he is going to find? It's going to be a real big factor. So I think, again, it's our clever author showing one side of the coin and allowing us to have an opportunity to see what we can do with it individually.
Absolutely, Joyce. And I think that, again, having the book that gives us 10 easy steps, any moment you're suffering, you could just give yourself a little check sheet of these 1 to 10. And then, as you said, just see the opposite and apply that as a tool. So a powerful book, even if you just put the key 10 points on a little note, if you don't want to look at your smart device, you could put it on a piece of paper or have it on your smart device and really bring that into your day, yeah, so you can ask those questions. And I know we've got Trina.
Yeah, I wanted to just take it a little step further too, because part of this chapter, he keeps going back to step 5, you know, the blame game, but he also moves it when and makes a point of saying easy step 9 is disempowering yourself. And that by blaming other people, by saying, they did this to me, they did this to me, they did this to me, you like take yourself out of the equation, but you completely remove the power. You disempower yourself completely. And you move into this place of, well, I can't do anything about it anyway. And, you know, I think every one of us has known people like that. And I knew a person who was really, really a powerful person, very engaged, always creating something, had some illnesses. And as they got older, you could just watch them move into that place instead of being in the, I'm going to go out, I'm going to make this happen, I can see where something needs to be solved, I have a solution, to saying, oh, I'm just not, you know, it kind of started with, well, I'm not really feeling up to it today, but they can take care of it. Kept moving deeper and deeper and deeper into this to a place where finally it was just like they described Bob in this, you know, or describe the other person. Something is always wrong. There's when you ask them, how you doing today? Oh, this hurts and that hurts and this isn't working and that's not working and this person was supposed to handle this. And so they move into these places and they get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And so when you do that, you take away your ability to create. You take away your ability to really be in charge of your life. And so another little piece, too, that made me think of listening to everybody is so many times when I'm talking with groups of people, especially people who have, like, conspiracy theories or they're mad about something or whatever, they always say, and they created this, and they're doing this, and they're doing this. And a lot of times I'll stop and say, who's they? Who is they? And there's so many times they can't even give an answer about who they is. So that's one of the things I tend to do with people a lot is when I hear them saying they, I'll say, define they. I want to know who they is. Tell me who they is. And sometimes it kind of pops them out of the place and they get a little bit more constructive and out of that nebulous they world. But it's interesting to watch how I think as a society actually we've been trained in some ways to look outside of ourselves all the time and not go inside. And I really do believe we've got to go in and we need to take our own responsibility for things. So that's my two cents again.
Yes, indeed. And Rosemary.
Yes, I just wanted to add to that. And I think that a lot of people, like what Joyce was sharing regarding the doctors, a lot of people are really hanging up their coat there in the doctor's office. And with the coat, they're also hanging up their responsibility for their body. I mean, it's so widespread that we just think in the moment we go to the doctor, take it and do something about it, yes? And that is a big thing where we need to help people. And I myself have read and done a lot of things to take responsibility for my body and to do the right thing and to help them to stay healthy or strong. And another thing which Marian said about the childhood and that this is often the cause that their situation in the childhood where we have a victim consciousness. And yes, there's a lot of children who are experiencing a strong sense of powerlessness and being out of control as children because parents have not been well trained in how to treat their children. And I work a lot with kids, and I always, one of my main things is always to constantly empower them to do more than what is usually expected. And people who have been with children know that when you let kids loose and you give them projects or you give them things to manage in the house or anything, they just jump right in. And it's always amazing for me, especially when they are in a group of same age, how they come up and the strong strengths that they have and the resources and the impulses and the ideas. So I think that is another thing I'm personally getting involved in a lot, is to help parents and to help the kids to move out of that sense of powerlessness or out of control because adults do everything, or I can't do it, or I'm too small, or I don't know. So I think that is really important that we all have our share in encouraging parents to have the kids do more than it is expected. Because the kids want to. They want to be more respected. They want to be more challenged. They want to be more powerful and not always feeling like someone is doing it to them. You hardly find a child who is actually saying, you know, just do it to me. A child wants, even it's often the other way, they want to do it themselves. So I think that is a thing I wanted to share. Thank you.
Absolutely, and it's a great sharing. It brings up, you know, there's a few principles, and one is that, you know, the conditions of exchange. You need to allow, you know, to keep things in balance allows one to feel good. So then the other word you used, and again, it's, as we said, what's been put together in the in having 10 easy ways to suffer allows us to say the opposites. And that word responsibility, whether it's ourselves, our work colleagues, young people, assisting them. And I remember hearing once from our usual host, Parisha, respond with ability. That's responsibility. And all of a sudden, it doesn't feel like a heaviness or a blame. It's like, who would like to be able to respond with ability to any situation? It's like, yeah, that sounds fantastic. Or who'd like to be able to respond with ability if you've gone home and the dinner isn't cooked for you? Yeah, then empower your kids to cook their own food, whatever it might be. Just think about assisting people respond with ability. And that leads us to this very last part of chapter 7, easy step number 9. It's only one paragraph, but we leave it with you because it's a powerful one. Easy step number 9 is disempower yourself. So this said, the fifth step is pretty passive, you know, the blame game, because they're doing it to you. And there's another section in this chapter that says there's billions of people. You don't even know them to be able to blame them. So there's no shortage of people you can blame. So to disempower yourself means you do not have any ability to respond. The chapter 7 concludes with, I'll read it, it's one sentence, which brings us to one of the linchpins of the phenomena of suffering, creating reality. So that's a wonderful place to conclude today's reading, and really focus as you like on that section.
I know Trina has a bit here to complete. I think he's leading us. I think he's leading us really into our solutions around this. Really taking a look at the suffering that we impose upon ourselves, and now it feels like we're beginning to move into a different direction a little bit. We still have one easy step left. But anyway, we're coming to the end of our hour here. And so maybe some of you want to take a look at your techno-suffering and the strategies you have, or maybe take a look at how you blame or become and play the victim of things this next week. And next week we're going to be moving on to Chapter 8, Creating Reality, in the book How to Suffer in 10 Easy Steps. So we would be really excited to have you all back and share some time with us next week. So again, it's time to conclude the studies for this week, and we want to thank you all for sharing your time and energy with us. You matter and you count, so you always make a difference. We look forward to being with us next week as we make that leap to greater consciousness. So have a powerful week and allow your light to shine, and always all good things to you. Have a fabulous week. We'll see you back next week on Quantum Leap Book Club on Law of Attraction Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club.
For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.